Good afternoon. I'm David Haynes, the opinions editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome to On Politics for Thursday, February 23rd. So here's what we're talking about today. Governor Walker does a reboot at CPAC this morning. We'll talk to Patrick Marley, who followed that speech. The ACLU sues Milwaukee Police Department. We'll talk to Ashley Luthern, our public safety reporter, about what's happening next with that. And then we're going to talk about, can we talk? Well, we found out on Tuesday night that we could, at least for one night, our Across the Divide project with WWM at Maxis. And we'll talk with Mary Spacuzza and Bill Glauber about that. We'll have your winners and losers and viewer questions. But first, I want to go to Patrick Marley, who just got done watching Governor Walker's speech to CPAC. Here's Patrick. So, Patrick, Governor Scott Walker spoke this morning at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. What did he have to say?
Well, he really talked about what happened with him in 2011 when he introduced Act 10 and the big protests that he faced, the recall attempt, and then the success of Republicans since then, and kind of tied it in with what's happening at the national level today, all the protests against Trump. Trying to tell conservatives they need to be strong, they need to stick to their principles, stick with what he calls big, bold reform, and telling them that they can withstand those protests and any other challenges they might face.
Did he talk specifically about what he'd like to see coming out of Washington, though? It's one thing to talk about standing firm, but for what?
Well, so after he gave about a 10-minute speech, and then from there, he went and sat down with three other Republican governors. Rick Graber from the Bradley Foundation had a little forum with them and talked about conservative governing. And Walker talked about the importance of returning power from the federal government to the states. He said that the federal government should be in charge of the military, maybe Social Security and Medicare, and that's about it. Otherwise, other programs should come home to the state. Specifically, he mentioned environmental protections. That should be left with Wisconsin's DNR and other states' DNRs instead of the Environmental Protection Agency.
So the governor is well-received at CPAC, no surprise there. But what else is he doing over the next few days to apparently gear up for the next campaign?
So he is, I mean, it's very clear. He hasn't made an official announcement, but it's very clear he is looking at re-election next year. He is now the chairman of the Republican Governors Association, which is a national group that elects governors. They're meeting this weekend in D.C., so he'll be hosting that. He's meeting with the Washington Post tomorrow. They're doing a live stream interview with him in his capacity as the head of the RGA. So that's kind of his agenda for the next few days on the political front.
Now, the RGA does give him a bit of a platform, right, to at least speak out on national issues.
Yes, and it also, you know, as chairman of the RGA, really one of your chief duties is to fundraise for the RGA, which can be a really big factor in governor's races. Maybe unlike other governors who take that role, the governor already has a very impressive fundraising list. You know, the recall really put him on the map and allowed him to develop this huge, huge group of fundraisers. I think for other governors, they step into that role and they make a bunch of new contacts. Governor Walker will obviously make some new ones, but the benefits of being chairman may not be as great for Walker as they have been.
Yeah, he has a running start. All right, yeah. Patrick Marley in Madison, thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
I want to go to a chat I had with Ashley Luthern, a public safety reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about a lawsuit that the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin filed this week against the Milwaukee Police Department. So now I'm joined by Ashley Luthern, a public safety reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Ashley, the ACLU of Wisconsin filed a lawsuit this week alleging that the Milwaukee Police Department is essentially violating the civil rights of thousands of people of color in our community. What specifically is that lawsuit alleging?
So the lawsuit is specifically alleging that the Milwaukee Police Department has a practice of high-volume traffic and pedestrian stops that are targeting, according to the ACLU, apparently targeting African-American and Latino people in our community disproportionately, and that these stops are taking place without an articulable suspicion or a specific reason for those stops, whether it be traffic enforcement or some other reason.
So basically they're saying they see a person of color on the street and they stop them, but they don't have any prior reason to think they should stop him, something to that effect.
Essentially. And yeah. of the named plaintiffs in the lawsuit, I believe there are half dozen, and they give specific examples of this happening to them in which they were stopped. They did not get a reason for the stop. They explain how the stop kind of infringed on their daily life and how they know that it's happened to other people in their community
okay.
as well.
So how has the police chief, Edward Flynn, responded to the lawsuit? What's he had to say so far?
So generally speaking, as a rule, the city and the police department don't respond to pending litigation. Chief Flynn came out very strong denying these allegations yesterday. He took particular umbrage with the assertion by the ACLU that this is a form of discrimination or mm-hmm. that this is a discriminatory practice. Mm-hmm. You know, his response has been the police department is in specific neighborhoods that are plagued by high rates of violence and that they are there to disrupt the environment. Mm-hmm. And he often points to the fact that many of these stops do not result in a ticket or an arrest. And he also points to the fact that even as these contacts have gone up, citizen complaints have declined. He uses that as sort of a justification or as evidence that this policy isn't being driven by the things that the ACLU believes it is driven
okay.
by.
So I think a lot of people would say this is about stop and frisk. Talk about what that means to different people, because I think Chief Flynn has said we've never had a stop and frisk policy, but yet I've also heard him say in meetings that we've had with him that we do want to disrupt behavior of the so-called bad guys in these communities. So where's that line?
I think that's what this lawsuit is trying to figure out, what that line is. Okay. And I think that's sort of what you've seen in other parts of the country, too. I do think that stop and frisk is such a catch-all. You know, people associate very specific things with it mm-hmm. that in some ways it's like a lot of buzzwords where it's sort of lost
meaning. It's not exactly a legal term.
Right. It's right. not exactly a legal term. So I think that this lawsuit is actually seeking to find, you know, what are the boundaries? And, you know, the ACLU says their entire goal with this is just to make sure that the Milwaukee Police Department is protecting people's constitutional rights as mm-hmm. they go about keeping the community safe.
And so finally, this is not the only time a lawsuit like this has been filed in elsewhere in the country. There have been lawsuits too, right?
Yes, there have been. The most famous example is in New York, in which, you know, it went through a couple different courts and ultimately resolved where, you know, the city wasn't going to continue appealing, and they, you know, decided to come to a resolution there where they were going to change their practices. And, you know, people who say that you don't have to do this kind of stop and frisk to maintain lower crime levels often point to New York as evidence of that.
Ashley, thanks.
Thanks, Dave.
So now we're back in studio in Milwaukee with Bill Glauber, a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Mary Spacuzza, another reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Mary, let me turn to you first. You were involved in the story this morning, I believe. There's a settlement in the Tony Robinson shooting case over in Madison. What are the details?
So this was the case stemming from a March 2015 police shooting where an unarmed biracial man was shot by a Madison police officer and killed. It was in a house, so really they were the only two people there. But the family had been arguing that although the officer was found not guilty of any criminal wrongdoing and investigations showed he didn't violate the police policy, that they filed a federal lawsuit, and that was settled this morning.
That was
apparently
settled today, and mm-hmm. for about
over $3 million. About $3.4 million is what we're hearing. Yeah. And there's actually should be a news conference starting momentarily with the family announcing that.
And to make it clear, it's quite controversial. The police union in Madison highly upset with this. They wanted the police officer to have his day in court.
Same with the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Jim Palmer, who was actually had represented mm-hmm. the officer. In the case, also said that he felt like he was extraordinarily disappointed that the officer wanted to defend himself. Tony, the young man who was killed, obviously everyone agrees it's a tragedy. He had taken mushrooms and a couple of other substances that day and really had a bad reaction to it, apparently, and was pretty aggressive with people on the street. And there were some 911 calls, actually a call from a friend called because they were concerned about him. He was believed, you know, he was alone in the house at the time, but the officer apparently didn't know that and thought that somebody may be, at least from his perspective, he thought somebody might be in immediate danger. So it is controversial, and I think we're probably going to hear from a lot of upset police officers.
Also,
the chief said it was a chilling effect.
And to be clear, the police officer himself, there were no charges filed against him.
No criminal charges.
No criminal charges filed. So
he was not fired.
And it's a tough case, and it's again a series of police shootings in the United States.
I was going to bring that up. The context for it is Dontre Hamilton in Milwaukee, and you name it, all over
Ferguson,
the country. Ferguson. I mean, all this was happening around the same time.
And the country is still coming to grips with that. Police are still coming to grips with it, sometimes in a good way, sometimes not in a good way, and it's still very controversial. And, you know, it's amazing that this has played out like this over the course of years. I mean, there have been police shootings, obviously, going back decades.
Yeah, I mean, really, the whole Black Lives Matter movement arose out of the police shootings.
Yes, and you know, we now have video cameras that are being used more often by police, body cams. So, you know, hopefully out of all of this really terrible, tragic situations, the society can get a grip on this. Police can use tactics that are effective and in hopefully in more cases not lethal. And this is not to blame police. But, you know, killing civilians is a terrible thing, whether it's a crime or not. It is, you know, a bad thing for society. I don't think anybody would disagree with that.
An officer said he was acting in self-defense, that he was afraid he could be knocked out or possibly have his gun taken away, that he felt like his life was in immediate danger. Obviously, the family feels differently and says that that's not the case. But they've said that it's affected his career dramatically.
Yeah, well, more to come on that. So we want to go now to a discussion that the Journal Sentinel sponsored this week with WWM 89.7 FM on political civility. Can we talk? And first, I'd like to have our panel look at a mashup, a segment that we recorded of highlights from that discussion on Tuesday night. So let's take a look.
And so you curate your Twitter feed to show you the stories that you want to hear or see, and you curate your Facebook feed and you curate your Instagram feed to show you what you want to see. And so therefore, while people may subsequently go out and listen to public radio or read the newspaper, what they're the first place apparently that many, many Americans get their information of the day is in that curated feed, which is then sort of, again, another place of bifurcation. Because you do not include in your tweet, in your Twitter feed or your Facebook feed, information from sources that you don't want to hear.
What we have to do is we have to resist the impulse to saying, it's those people that they're stupid, they're dumb, they don't listen, and maybe, you know, try to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and try to presume that, they might actually be operating in good faith, and maybe I should try to understand what they're saying, even if it's really, really hard and I don't want to try to do it.
And so you're hearing always this antagonism. And so the anger that has sort of been exposed during a campaign period, during an election period, never goes away. And in a certain sense, when I've looked at it in terms of sort of political dynamics, it's really hard to put that back in a bottle. And so what we have is this constant fever pitch of political antagonism. And I think that's a lot of what, you know, we sort of have a difficulty talking across divides because we never have an opportunity to catch our breath and have a conversation because we're constantly in this sort of antagonistic civic place.
If you're outraged, stop. You know, maybe you shouldn't be. If you're offended, stop. Maybe you shouldn't be. At least ask yourself the question as to why it is that you're so angry and why it is that you're so convinced that whoever you're defining yourself in opposition is sort of irredeemable or deplorable or, you know, whatever you want to call them. Because, again, the odds are that they're probably not. And you may, come away just as you probably will come away. just as committed to your position as you were before, but maybe you'll at least understand why somebody else sees things differently, and that may at least become the precursor for civil peace, if for nothing else.
So the Journal Sentinel and WWM intend to do more of these. Bill, I want to turn to you first. You were there, so was Mary. You've covered politics for years. You were on the editorial board at the Chicago Tribune for a while. How has the discourse changed, in your opinion, or has it changed?
I think it has changed. People are more aggressive in tone. I think certainly Donald Trump was. Even Ron Johnson in his campaign against Russ Feingold, you know, they exchanged words back and forth. I just think that it's part of this 24/7 news culture. To get break through the noise, you have to make more noise. And I don't think it's going back. You know, what the conversation lacked was somebody saying, this is great, you know, a divergent opinion about that.
Well, in fact, a lot of conservatives will say from time to time that you always pick on us for being the bad guys here, but political combat is really how you get things done. You come to an agreement eventually.
Well, except in the current climate, they haven't come to an agreement on anything for years. Not even facts. The Congress is, you know, just ground to a halt. So, you know, maybe we should be quieter. I'm not sure that's, like I said, it's ever going to go back. I thought Lily Gorin's remark to begin the conversation was actually the most telling. She sees the country as at its most divided and polarized since the Civil War. Hopefully we're not that bad and we're going to take up arms against one another.
And she actually has she has data to back that up. That's not based just on her opinion, which I found very striking too. Mary, let me turn to you. You covered the Act 10 protests in Madison, which for all of us in Wisconsin was where a lot of the turmoil in our politics started, for better or worse, whether you agreed with it or not. What do you see in your experience in covering politics?
You know, it's funny because the Packers won the Super Bowl shortly before Act 10, and it felt
like
the whole state was united in the glory of the green and gold. And then shortly thereafter, it was like everyone was at each other's throats. And it was interesting because being at the center of it in the Capitol press corps, up in the press room, and seeing all this unfold was pretty remarkable. And, you know, we did have peaceful protests for the most part. You know, people can argue about a few scuffles, but it's really remarkably peaceful, but extremely heated. And I felt like on a daily basis, I would get emails starting at about 4 a.m. about how evil I was. And it was either somebody who thought I was being bribed by the Koch brothers or somebody who thought I was being bribed by the unions and had read the same story, but come away with this idea that the press was against them. And it was, so in a way, I kind of feel like I don't know that this election cycle has been that much more divided in Wisconsin than 2011 and during the recalls of 2012, where people were just like hate mail, hate calls was a pretty, maybe every 15 minutes, maybe every five. So I don't know that it's gotten that much worse in Wisconsin. In some ways, it feels like the rest of the country has kind of caught up to how rancorous Wisconsin politics have been since 2011.
You know, a British colleague of ours, Gavin Esler, he worked for the BBC. He, you know, he wrote a book back in the 90s called The United States of Anger. And that was in the 90s. That's now 20 years ago. And so the anger keeps coming back at a bigger, larger boil. I think that's the period we're in.
Well, let's leave it at that. More to come on that. And again, we plan more of these discussions. At least I believe that face-to-face conversations is an opportunity at least to find some common ground. So we'll try to keep doing that. Winners and losers. So, Mary, I'm going to go to you first. Who's your loser this week?
Okay, I'm going to go with somebody whose name I'm going to completely mispronounce, but is it Milo? Milo?
Milo.
I usually don't talk about him too much because he seems to want attention so much. But in this case,
Milo, yeah. Yiannopoulos.
Correct. There you go. Thank you. Thank you for saving me.
I'm not going to say Giannis's name, though.
Until very recently, he was going to be the keynote at CPAC, the big conservative event. He had this big book deal. Those thing. He lost both of those things, as well as his job at Breitbart this week after some comments surfaced where he seemed to be defending pedophilia. And I think a lot of people were wondering, what will this guy have to say for people to, you know, break ties with him? And it appears that condoning pedophilia was it, because he's had a remarkable fall this week.
Although now I hear that he might have a different book deal coming.
I would not be surprised.
Yep. We probably haven't heard the end of Milo. Oh, all
probably
right.
Not.
So, who's your winner?
So I'm going to go with the Swedes, who, contrary to...
The Swedes.
contrary
it's
to...
It's our Swedish nation.
Sure we...
They thank you.
Yes. They, you know, obviously the president appears to have been watching a Fox News report that was talking... Yeah. I think it was a...
Tucker Carlson.
Correct. Yeah. And he was talking to a documentarian who was talking about migrant violence, and that he felt that there were Muslim refugees who were committing horrible acts of violence in Sweden. However, when the president mentioned it at a rally in Florida over the weekend, it made it sound like there had been some horrific terrorist attack the night before in Sweden. And of course, everyone started trying to find out what had happened in Sweden. And it turned out, according to the Swedes, really no dramatic terrorist attack had happened. And they were kind of wondering where he was coming from and saying, like, we're doing just fine, thank you. So, you know, certainly there may be some acts of violence, and maybe we'll hear more about that, but it does not appear there was any kind of major attack that we should be aware of.
There was some pushback from the Swedish government, too.
Yeah, they were very outspoken.
On the movie maker, the documentary film. Yeah.
And against Trump, I think, for
Trump.
Saying, you know, we rely on the United States president to be extremely well-informed and to think about the importance of what he says and the impact it can have. And when somebody, it's one thing for a documentarian to say it, although they should be responsible too, but if then the president says it, that's obviously a much huger platform for something that does not seem to have been a widespread terrorist attack.
Pushback is too general a word. They were laughing at the president. Let's face it.
And maybe all of us. I don't know. But
they may need to recalculate their assumption that the president is going to act in the way past presidents have.
And he certainly does not seem to, he's kind of writing his own playbook, so.
It appears that way. All right, Bill, so who's your loser?
Milwaukee County taxpayers, you know, they've been taking it in the shorts for years on the pension scandal. And now, you know, the details that there was pension money going out that was more than should have been going out. The person who was overseeing the pensions just basically took their eye off the ball. She's out. So at least that has ended. And then, of course, they at least know county taxpayers. They do know the whereabouts of County Sheriff David A. Clark, Jr. this week. He's at CPAC in Washington, D.C.
And he's got a bobblehead in his name.
He has a bobblehead and a book.
And lip balm. I think there's David Clark lip balm.
All right. So, Bill, who's your winner?
And the winner is Jim Sensenbrenner. You know, year after year, he just goes out and does town hall meetings. Yep. He has, I believe, 14 of them scheduled for the next couple of weeks, beginning in March. You know, you can go talk to him, meet him afterward. And given all the ruckus at these town hall meetings, the fact that he still does it the old-fashioned way is commendable. There are several other politicians in this state who seem to have given up on it, but not sensibly. Yeah.
It's interesting because there was actually a Ron Johnson town hall, like an empty chair town hall in his honor, I think, in Madison last night, where it was a bunch of constituents and a chair for Ron Johnson, who obviously was not there. But they've been really critical of these telephone town halls he's been having, and I've heard from people saying they didn't even know when it was happening. They suddenly got a call and were supposed to, you know, be part of this town hall. It felt like he was ducking people.
There is in Wisconsin a long history of face-to-face meetings, going back to Bill Proxmire and Feingold and other politicians here. So, all right, so those are our winners and losers. Let's go to a couple of questions from our viewers. The first one is, and I may take a whack at this one with your help.
Okay.
I'm in favor of a free press, but not free to publish anything without backing it up, without proof. Do you have the ability, that is the Journal Sentinel, to say no to USA Today if it wants you to publish something? I hope so. If not, I have lost all faith and hope in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Well, you can continue to have faith and hope in us because we operate independently of USA Today. We make our own publishing decisions, our own news decisions. We do publish material from USA Today and other partners in the Gannett group. We're particularly doing a lot of content sharing these days with our partners out in the state of Wisconsin. markets like Green Bay and Manitowoc and Sheboygan, Wausau. And that's important because they're covering stories that we're not out covering. So that content sharing is actually a big idea behind the Gannett Group, both the network, both in Wisconsin and nationally. Anything you guys want to add?
USA Today does a good job. And
they do.
People should believe what they're publishing. The journalists in the Gannett chain, you know, take their responsibility very serious. And I think that the public should accept that we're doing our best.
Yeah.
I think that people have kind of taken this fake news label and run with it a bit. So when I was reporting, for example, this week on a JCC bomb threat at the Whitefish Bay Jewish Community Center, part of a wave nationally of these threats, there were some more today, I hear, in other parts. So somebody labeled that as fake news. Or, for example, when I was covering the immigrant protest, the Day Without Latinos, a week or two ago, and somebody else called that fake news. And it's like, well, no, there actually was a bomb threat, and we are reporting it. And
we have a real person there talking to people about it.
Correct, and we are here. There are a lot of people protesting. So I think, in a way, people maybe need to realize that just because they don't agree with what the press is publishing, that it's not fake news.
Yeah, well, good point. All right, one more about Donald Trump's news conference from last week. And the viewer says, wasn't it remarkable that he took questions for over an hour, that he tried to get to as many as possible? Don't you agree that that's something that a lot of presidents wouldn't have done, did it without a teleprompter? Wasn't that presidential? And how was that going on offense, as at least one network reporter described it? So the viewer basically is saying he or she thinks Trump did a great job by facing the press and spending, you know, almost 90 minutes out there. What's your reaction to that?
I think this is going to be one of those partisan things where his diehard supporters are going to think it was great and that he really gave it to the press. I think his critics are going to say he seemed unhinged. For me, I thought that, you know, while it's commendable to talk to the press for 90 minutes, some of his answers were pretty shocking and just seemed like I didn't know where he was coming from. Asking, for example, April Ryan, a veteran reporter who's covered multiple presidents, who asked him about meeting with the Congressional Black Caucus. She's an African-American reporter, and he basically asked, are these friends of yours? Do you want to set up a meeting? And kind of answered her questions, too, but it was just a very odd response, I thought. Or the Jewish reporter, there's an Orthodox Jewish reporter who asked about these bomb threats and was really dressed down and yelled at for it and told to sit down. So I don't think a lot of his critics would see that as presidential behavior. I think they would see that as pretty shocking and kind of unhinged.
I just remember Trump in the setting of running boxing matches in Atlantic City back in the 80s, early 90s. So I view it more as a sports writer give and take, which I think the Washington Press Corps should probably do. Make your questions simple and sit back and, you know, the guy's going to come at you. And that's just the way it is. I don't think there's any changing that. And but again, keep the questions simple, and I think you'll get some interesting answers.
So, but Trump has continued to attack the press beyond the press conference.
So what? Who cares? That is his prerogative to do that, whether he's right or wrong. Yeah. And you just got to hang in there and keep asking the questions.
Absolutely.
It hurts to get attacked, but you got to keep in there and keep asking him the questions.
I agree with that, but I wonder if the tweet last week,
enemy of the American people,
the press is the enemy of the American people, didn't cross a line we haven't seen crossed before, except in Richard Nixon's secret tapes.
Yeah.
Years ago.
I just, you know, I let it go over my head. It's not comfortable to have. I think he's wrong. But, you know, it's up to us to prove our worth and to prove our objectivity.
All right.
So I hope he keeps talking to the press, though. But I do think he's, you know, obviously the president, and people pay attention to every word he says. And he probably needs to think about the words he's saying and how people will take them.
All right. Well, we're going to keep trying to prove our worth every Thursday here at On Politics. My thanks to Mary Spacuzza and Bill Glauber, Ashley Lutheran and Patrick Marley. I'm David Haynes with the opinion section of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks for watching.